A headline from a Wall Street Journal opinion piece this week: San Francisco has become a shoplifter's paradise. It was reaction to Walgreens shuttering nearly two dozen locations, and the forces driving those closures is being debated. We're looking at organized retail theft closer to home in Wisconsin on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The National Retail Federation published its annual national survey on retail security in August. More than two-thirds of retailers said they had seen an increase in organized retail crime activity over the past year, citing reasons like COVID, like policing, like the growth of online marketplaces for stolen goods. What are your thoughts about a surge in shoplifting? 800-642-1234. Joe Tashler is a reporter and editor for the business desk of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's been reporting on how retailers are fighting theft rings. Joe, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So much of your reporting on these orchestrated thefts is centered in the village of Grafton, which I thought was really interesting, in Ozaukee County, north of Milwaukee. Can you explain what's going on?
Well, one of the things that I was seeing when I was just in reporting during earnings calls, when the companies get together with analysts and talk about their earnings, it kept coming up that losses from theft were growing. And I'm like, So we started looking into it, and sure enough, the amount of retail theft has skyrocketed. And we just happened to look at Grafton because there's a number of major retailers right in that corridor with the Interstate 43 and State Highway 60, where at that interchange, number of major retailers looked at the police department's annual report to the public and realized that close to 70% of the calls that the police department handles in Grafton are for retail theft.
70%. Wow.
I think the numbers were 178 total crime reports during the year, and 118 of those, so 118, were for retail theft.
Grafton is an interesting contrast because the National Retail Federation's security survey says the top three cities where organized retail crime is occurring is L.A., San Francisco Bay Area, and Chicago. So while that survey is citing these very large cities, you're saying this problem is even striking small villages.
Right. You know, that's one thing in the reporting, I talked to one of the Home Depot's chief investigators, and he told me, he said, you know, this used to be a situation that was primarily occurring in the larger cities. So, you know, a Home Depot, you know, on the north side of Chicago, or in an urban area of Los Angeles. Now, he said, they're seeing every one of their stores across the country being hit. It doesn't matter if it's in a suburban area or an urban area, it's their stores are being hit everywhere. And, you know, doing the reporting, we found out that was happening to more than just Home Depot.
Well, draw a distinction here. This is very different from minor shoplifting. What does it mean to be organized theft rings?
Well, that's one thing I asked. I said, well, you know, how much of this is somebody, you know, going to a grocery store and, you know, shoplifting milk and eggs so they can feed their kids? And they said, that just doesn't happen. These are people who are organized. They know what they're after. They go in and take large quantities of merchandise, oftentimes pushing it right out the front door. And then at least the retailers, the brick and mortar retailers, say they turn around and sell it on online marketplaces.
We're going to talk about those online marketplaces in a moment. We have Joe Tashler with us, reporter, editor for the business desk of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's been writing recently about an increase in organized theft rings hitting retail stores in Wisconsin and really all across the nation. You can join in. What are your thoughts about the surge in shoplifting? What do you think can be done about the organized crime effort? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Joe, as you talk with law enforcement officials and others who are watching the shifting movement of these theft rings, what is their approach to this?
They're trying everything they can with the resources that they have. Our reporters have done stories about the Milwaukee Police Department and how, with the rate of homicides, they won't come out and say that they're overwhelmed, but let's just say that the police department is pretty busy. So then you have suburban police departments who might not have the significant crimes to investigate. They're trying everything technology. In Grafton, they've gotten all their retailers together to have a meeting with the police once a quarter to say, okay, what's going on? What are you seeing? They're trying sharing of intelligence so you can identify people who are going around the country, literally, and hitting stores. So there's a number of things they're doing.
As you're on these earnings calls, you know, loss prevention has always been a division or a category of retailers. They have whole departments that focus on loss prevention. What are you hearing from the retail side?
From the retail side, at least from Home Depot, when I talk to them, they are going after, they're using what the federal government has done for generations to go after organized crime, which is go after the top, go after the people at the top. And so that's what they do. They're going after people who are stealing. I think the example they gave me was $50,000 worth of merchandise in 3 weeks. The loss prevention people are almost their own detectives, where they will put a case together and then they'll take it to law enforcement and say, here's what we have. Here's the evidence that we have. Can you go prosecute?
Now, please act. So literally, taking that evidence, dropping it in their lap and saying, here you go. Will you act now?
Right. I mean, that's what they're trying to do. But, again, with strained resources of police departments, you're not going to pull somebody off a homicide investigation to have them go do a retail theft case. It's just not going to happen. So what they're trying to do is put together really big cases against the people at the top, where police and prosecutors are going to be more likely to initiate a prosecution.
We have the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Joe Tashler has been reporting on organized theft activity and how Wisconsin retailers and police departments are responding. Have you heard of these organized theft rings here or in other states? Do you think they have a ripple effect on the price you pay for items? Do you work in loss prevention in the retail industry? What have you noticed? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Joe Tashler here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the uptick in organized retail crime here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to the 2021 National Retail Security Survey, retailers report people who are part of organized theft rings are more aggressive and violent than in years past. Some 65% of respondents noted the increase in violence. Top stolen items are designer clothes and laundry detergent. That data comes from the trade group and the lobbying organization, National Retail Federation, that puts out the survey. Do you work in retail? What is your store's policies for dealing with shoplifting and theft? Join in 800-642-1234. Joe Tashler is a reporter and editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel with us for about 9 more minutes. Joe, you know, what are thieves doing with the goods that they're stealing, sometimes in bulk?
One of the things I found out in the reporting is a lot of these stolen goods show up on online marketplaces. And that has set up a battle, if you will, between big retail and big tech. Big retail wants more identification and stricter rules for people who sell goods as third parties on online marketplaces.
And when you say online marketplaces, you mean like your Amazon, say, or perhaps sure. eBay?
Sure, Amazon, eBay, to a lesser extent, Etsy. And there are new online marketplaces popping up every day, according to the loss prevention folks I've talked to. The Amazons and the eBays of the world say that they accuse the brick and mortar retailers of trying to drive a wedge into the business model that they've established by putting new requirements and more onerous identification requirements on third-party sellers. There's federal legislation, there's legislation being pursued at state houses across the country, and it has turned into quite a fight between brick and mortar and online.
Well, it's interesting, too, that some stores think the online forum, the online environment, needs to police the sellers more and to be more stringent about what products are for sale online. What do you see going on there? What are the dynamics?
Well, the brick and mortar retailers say that they, you know, they have to police their stores regularly. They could never sell dangerous or stolen goods out of their brick and mortar retail storefronts. And they are pushing to have the Amazons and eBays of the world police their storefronts, even though they're electronic, in the same manner. They also argue that it's very easy to anonymously sell items on some of these marketplaces, but specifically, you know, you read between the lines and their ire is directed at Amazon, clearly.
And you mentioned the legislation afoot. There's a bill in Congress aiming to address the fight between tech and retail here. Can you tell us about the Inform Act?
Yeah, it was introduced in this session of Congress. I honestly don't know where it is in the process or what its prospects are. Mm-hmm. But it would create more stringent requirements on people like Amazon to know who their sellers are and make their sellers' identities more readily available to consumers. And eBay says, you know, we're already doing that. You don't have to go 2 or 3 mouse clicks into a listing to see who the person is who's selling it. Mm-hmm. Clearly, again, this is a beef with Amazon, where it does take a mouse click or two to figure out who some of the third-party sellers are on that platform.
We're talking with Joe Tashler, who's a reporter and editor for the business desk of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's been writing recently about an increase in organized theft rings hitting retail outlets in Wisconsin and elsewhere in the country. You can join in. Have you heard of these organized theft rings? How do you think that they should be prosecuted, or what should happen at the retail level to stop this? 800-642-1234. Joe, have you looked into how successful prosecution has been when going after these organized theft rings?
Not as much as I probably should have. I've seen reports from the Justice Department, the U.S. Justice Department. There was a father-daughter team
in Atlanta,
who I want to say they moved $5 million worth of stolen goods and had a
warehouse.
A warehouse and just a regular group of people who would steal things for them that they would resell. That was their business. And that's the other thing that's important that law enforcement says, and that you mentioned about the increasingly brazen nature of some of these thefts. This is what people do for a living. This is their job. The retailers have largely told their employees, don't intervene. We don't want anybody getting hurt. And that's part of the equation as well.
So the protocol is not to stop it on the employee side, not to intervene, not to escalate.
Right. That is the mantra or the marching orders, if you will, for employees when these thefts occur.
I wonder, do you know anything about the trickle-down effect on what these thefts have, if there's any ripple effect on the prices that consumers are buying for items in the store?
The retailers will tell you no, that they have the massive loss prevention departments that you mentioned earlier in order to prevent that from happening and keep that keep the losses from making their way into the consumer's pocketbook. But clearly, with the size of the losses, and I think you mentioned this, it was approaching in that survey from the National Retail Federation, they were estimating close to $62 billion across the country. Clearly, those losses are going to have to be absorbed somewhere.
They are going to have to come from somewhere. Yeah.
They're going to have to come from somewhere. So while the retailers won't come out and say that, it's got to come from somewhere.
I wonder, too, the impact that staffing is having and the staffing and labor shortages we're seeing straight across industries. Maybe stores just don't have the staff or the security to address it as well.
Clearly, yes. If you have one clerk working at the front of the store, that's an easy target for somebody to load up a cartload of air conditioners, power tools. I've heard people around Thanksgiving will load up carts full of turkeys and they'll just run out of the store. If you have a diminished or lesser number of people working, that clearly can't help but embolden someone. I would think it would just be common sense to run out of a store with a cartload of merchandise that they didn't pay for.
I wonder have these theft rings always been there, or is this has been an unusual rise or result from the pandemic?
That's one thing I looked at, and the rate of employee theft or inside jobs, if you will, has remained stagnant over time. The retailers have not seen an increase in that. So clearly something has gone on that that has emboldened people to go into stores and grab large quantities of merchandise and run out with it. Now, whether that's a pandemic, people are studying that, but like so many other things in life, because of the pandemic, I'm sure it's had something to do with it.
Yeah. Joe, thank you for sharing your reporting with us.
Well, thank you for having me on your show. This is a treat. This is great.
Appreciate it. Joe Tashler is a reporter and editor for the business desk of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We have a link to his reporting on organized retail crime. It's at WPR.org/mornings. Ahead this hour, a Janesville farmer explains how he's trying to reduce emissions and greenhouse gases on thousands of acres. How do you think farming and grazing practices should change? What does sustainable agriculture mean to you? And what do you want to ask this farmer in Janesville about his practices? Join in 800-642-1234. News update is next. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about family names.
In most cities and towns, there are last names that stick out. Maybe the family has lived there for generations, perhaps they're notorious, or maybe they own a well-known business. For writer Sandy Reitman of Milwaukee, her semi-famous last name sticks out mostly thanks to her beloved uncle.
As a kid, I woke up to the sound of my uncle's voice on my little white FM radio alarm clock every morning before school, along with half the city of Milwaukee.
94 WKTI Milwaukee, Reitman and Miller at 5 o'clock. Let me start off your Monday morning.
My Uncle Bob was the Reitman half of Reitman and Miller in the morning on 94.5 WKTI Milwaukee, playing the music of the 80s, 90s, and today for many years. He was a big voice with a unique last name in a small city. But the last name didn't start its recognition there. My grandfather, Robert Reitman Sr., was an FBI agent and served as commissioner of the Whitefish Bay Police and Fire Department, so his name was known about town. His namesake son, Bob, the radio host, was the total anti-culture of his father, becoming somewhat of a civil rights movement activist and the city's original hipster. His career started on public radio, then on to underground radio, to morning radio, and now full circle back to public radio. His listeners have loyally followed him along the way, also remembering the Reitman last name. The first time I remember learning that it was unusual to have your uncle on the radio was when my elementary school music teacher repeated a fact that she had learned about me on the radio that morning. Maybe it was my birthday or something, I can't really remember, but I was beyond confused and embarrassed that this teacher and now my entire class could learn things about me on the radio. After school, I talked to my parents about how it all works, and I soon became much more interested in the fame that came with my name than whatever was bothering me earlier. My big brother, Kevin, was an active Boy Scout around that time and took his whole troop with him to the WKTI radio studio for some kind of patch earnings activity. I, of course, tagged along with all the boys. I remember being in the sound production room while the troupe was in the studio, amazed to see how radio works behind the scenes. This was my first backstage moment of my life. My parents were used to the "Are you related to Bob Reitman?" question as they grew up hearing it. My dad had the little brother complex, but also made his own name for himself. As I got older, my friends' parents started to ask me more about my uncle and what's he really like, and I would engage their questions. But around town, he was just a likable guy. When I was old enough to make purchases with a debit card, cashiers would ask me, "Are you related to Bob Reitman?" And I would oblige this question from strangers because I was proud to be his niece. I ran off to New York City for 10 years, only to get a couple "Are you related to Ivan or Jason Reitman?" questions. famous Hollywood directorial family of which I'm not related to, but occasionally would lie and say I was just to get the reaction. When I moved back to Milwaukee in my early 30s, I noticed that the Reitman question came up less and less. I started to miss being asked it, actually. Recently, this whole saga came full circle when someone asked my dad, "Are you Bob Reitman's son?" That was all the validation my dad needed after years of being the disc jockey's little brother. I recently reconnected with my elementary school art teacher, also a Milwaukee native who listened to my uncle her whole life. She told me a story where she was talking about Reitman on the radio, and whomever she was speaking to said, "Oh, like Sandy Reitman?" Full stop, full circle. I had officially moved from BTS to VIP status. So, what's in a semi-known German-Jewish last name in a big, small city like Milwaukee? For me, it's a sense of pride and an even bigger sense of comfort. We Reitmans are at home when in Milwaukee.
Sandy Reitman is a writer who lives in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now to a Janesville farm and how to reduce the impact of agriculture practices on climate change. Farmers are critical in the work of slashing greenhouse gases in the U.S. Agriculture in our country accounts for more than 10.5% of planet warming greenhouse gas emissions. And those are estimates from the Agriculture Department. Are you a farmer? Have you changed your practices to try to be more environmentally sustainable? What have you done? Join in 800-642-1234. Willie Hughes is a sixth-generation farmer in Janesville. His family runs W. Hughes Farms and Blue Farm Chips with 5,000 acres. Willie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, take us on a tour, if you will. Show us around a bit the farm. Tell us about it.
Yeah, sure. You said it correctly. We are operating today about 5,000 acres in Rock County here, the primarily southwestern part of the county. And today we are a parallel production specialty crop operation, meaning about just under 2,000 acres are managed as certified organic, and the rest is generally food grade, conventional non-GMO. We have in the last couple of years really, ventured inward and tried to tackle what it means to be a benchmark for a sustainable operation in the 21st century. We're incorporating a lot of cover crops. We're extending our rotations. We're doing a lot of no-till and collaborating with, other ag adjacent institutions in the area to kind of move that flag forward.
Yeah. And I'm just wondering if you ever think about how, your grandparents farmed on that land and, how different the practices today are versus, when things started around 170 or so years ago.
Yeah. Well, what I wouldn't give to be able to have a conversation with them. Certainly things have changed. I'm a little envious that, they might not have had some of the big questions to answer. They weren't necessarily burdened by that, but they certainly had, other challenges that that I haven't experienced. So, there's give and take, but as I kind of think more about it and examine what I'm doing, I find more and more of, a sense of sort of returning more towards, the direction they were headed. So, it's fun to think about. I've got some old family photos and, one example is my great, great grandma Maud, grew industrial hemp, for the war effort in the fiber. And, this is our third year, raising industrial hemp and, that's had its challenges and stuff. But it sure looks from the photos that she really knew how to grow a crop. So I'd like to pick her brain.
Oh, it's like a family heirloom crop, if you will.
Yeah.
Why did your family start growing organic decades ago?
Originally it was not by choice. That was just the way things were done. In about 1991, my dad identified the opportunities for the market and we sort of ventured into certified organic, which is, mm-hmm. It's its own thing. And, so we've been at it for, just about 30 years now. And, we're still learning as we go. We still have room for improvement. But I really feel that, we've learned a lot from that experience, and the approaches and the practices are really cross-pollinating with our conventional side of the business in a way. And we're incorporating, more cover cropping on our conventional acres. No-till on the conventional side is a little more straightforward. And that certainly I feel does have a spot to in climate mitigation. We've been at that for about 30 years.
We're going to get to cover crops in a moment, but I want to ask you, there's been this tension around getting the certified organic label. And, farmers have said it's incredibly difficult to get the certification, obeying all regulations for several years, paying fees for those years before using the organic label. What are the barriers you see, or what have you learned?
Well, I think that's generally correct. There's always two sides to that argument. One is mm-hmm. it's prohibitive for small growers, to have access to those markets. The other side of it is that those high standards those standards are set so that the consumer has confidence that what they're getting is legitimate. And so that's always the question. And I think as the organic industry grows and becomes a larger and larger share of the food that consumers are buying, that there's always going to be that push and pull between those two. I can tell you from experience that yes, maintaining the standards and being able to do the audit is very time consuming. It can be costly to, just clean out logs and transaction certificates, and it's a whole thing. And I feel personally, from my experience, that is a good thing. I understand that it could be prohibitive for growers, but I think at the end of the day, the consumer has to have that trust in the organic label and strict standards are the only way that that'll happen.
Strict standards there for a reason. I want to give you this hypothetical. Let's say you're a larger crop operation where you haven't necessarily had a great rotation of crops for a long time. You haven't been building up that soil health or paying real close attention to soil health. What advice do you have for a farmer who wants to transition to organic but is really struggling with changing their operations and getting that certification process going?
I would say that the first step is to work with cover crops. I think that is some really low hanging fruit where you can begin to, improve your soil structure, improve your organic matter, reduce runoff. I don't know if the organic certification is for every farm. I mean, it's definitely, a tough thing. But extending your rotation, implementing cover crops, finding specialized markets, finding customers that value that value-added product, that's all where it starts.
Willie Hughes with us, his family. They've been farming in Rock County for more than 170 years. We're learning about his practices on the farm to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Do you grow crops or work on a farm? Have you changed your practices recently to try to be more environmentally sustainable? Tell us about what you've done, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Willie Hughes here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're talking about one farm's approach to sustainability. The Hughes Farm has been working the land for over 170 years. They've been certified organic, as we've been talking about, for 30 years. Cover crops, rotations, heating, lighting, irrigation, runoff control, all in the mix. We're looking at their farming practices and what the future holds in the face of climate change. What questions do you have for a working farmer and the operational challenges in this climate crisis? 800-642-1234. Farmer Willie Hughes is with us for about 9 more minutes. You know, you're talking there about cover crops, and, you know, that is one way that you're trying to lessen the impact of the farming operations. Explain what are cover crops and how they help.
Yeah, absolutely. A cover crop or continuous living cover is really anything that is planted typically in the late summer or fall that grows really for the sole purpose of, putting roots down in the soil and covering that soil for that period of the year where the field is not productive. Obviously, having roots and a canopy of some sort prevents wind and water erosion. It can slow runoff. It can increase organic matter, and it can improve the recycling of that organic matter, which can contribute to carbon sequestration. As that organic matter builds slowly over time, you're going to see improved soil structure, moisture, and nutrient holding capacity. You're going to have improved biological activity in the soil. It can also be referred to as a catch crop. So what we're doing now typically is we're currently laying compost and animal-based manures out and then putting a cover crop over those in order to catch that and immobilize those nutrients so they stay out of the groundwater and out of the, out of the streams and rivers. And then in the fall, we will plow those down or terminate them and plant into them. You can grow nitrogen with things like clover or hairy vetch. So there's different, different cover crops have different uses. We typically will plant clover after a small grain in the summer or frost seed it right into the small grain in the early winter. And that's going to fixate nitrogen into the soil that gives us a nitrogen credit for the following year. So when you look at fertilizer prices today and how a cost of production has increased, using cover crops to grow nitrogen is something that I think a lot of growers are looking at more and more.
With your
go ahead.
I was just going to jump in with your cereal rye as a cover crop. Are there any issues with cereal rye because, tying up nitrogen that is needed for the early corn growth? Have you had any issues there with that nitrogen?
You can have tie up. Absolutely. It's important to get, that cover crop worked down in a timely manner so that you don't have that issue. But yes, if you plow up a cover crop field and plan on planting it the next day, you will definitely have some tie up. One of the things that we do to mitigate that is the use of biological amendments. So we're putting liquid products in furrow. You could essentially refer to it maybe as like a glorified compost tea. The specific product we use is called CX1 by Purple Cow. And adding biology with minerals means that uptake occurs more readily. And having that biology helps the plant. The biology essentially attaches to the plant, right? And it converts it, mineralizes, and makes those nutrients available to the plant. And in exchange, the plant gives the microbes, root exudates, sugars. And so there's a symbiotic relationship there. And we feel that by putting that in furrow, that's one thing that we can do to help, kind of kickstart that process.
You've been also experimenting with weed control and with electricity to control weeds. What are you doing there?
It's a little bit of a kind of a mad scientist approach, but we have a tool called the Weed Zapper, and it probably gets more attention than most of the pieces of steel on the farm, but essentially, to kind of explain it to the listeners, you might see a sprayer go down a field and it's got a really long boom in front of it. Well, instead of a herbicide, this is essentially a giant copper conductive rod, and it works just basically on a height differential. So you set the position of that rod, and anything that's taller than that gets electrocuted. On the back of the tractor, there's a, I think it's about a 200,000 watt generator pushing 15,000 volts, 400 to 500 amps when it's really going.
Wow.
And it sends a shock of electricity. You know, obviously the weed makes ground with the contact with ground and sends the electricity right through it and bursts the cell walls. And it has its challenges. It's not as effective as a herbicide pass. The more woody the stem, the more hollow the stem, the less effective. So and then also weeds that are shorter, you know, there's multiple passes involved because they have to grow up above the canopy. But in terms of reducing the seed bank for next year, and in terms of, you know, some of the resistance we're seeing, especially like ragweeds and some of our non-GMO food beans and things like that, it's a pretty handy rescue tool.
That's fascinating. So, we're talking with Willie Hughes, sixth generation farmer in Janesville, looking at environmentally sustainable practices on the farm. With your questions, 800-642-1234. Willie, I want to talk about blue farm chips because, full disclosure, my kids eat them. They love them.
All right.
Can you, you know, blue corn is commonly grown in the Southwest, and your family, I understand, shifted to some blue corn production in the 80s when no one was growing it. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, I can tell you that we're still at it. We've had... growing a specialty food corn in our area is a challenge. We do feel that we've identified a varietal that works fairly well. We have some this year, and we'll be harvesting it here pretty soon. It's a longer day corn. It's really not meant to be grown this far north, but we farm primarily on some sandier, more marginal ground, frankly, and that more arid environment. We seem to be able to get away with it, especially the last few years. It seems to be fairly well adapted to our area. We grow the corn, and we have it cleaned locally, and the chips are made down in South Beloit, just about 10 miles from our farm.
Oh, wow. How do you protect your crops from neighboring farms that use pesticides then?
Well, that's always a challenge. You really can't tell other growers how to farm or what to do. Uh-huh. We have some great relationships. We have great neighbors, and they always know when we call that we're up to something, goofy. And so we try to stagger plant dates. Pollination timing is really critical, to make sure that, you don't have, speckled corn or anything like that. Isolation, a staple of organic management is a buffer. So if we're adjacent to a conventional field, we have to harvest a buffer and haul that in as conventional.
Well, Willie, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your operations.
Thank you.
Willie Hughes is a sixth-generation farmer in Janesville. His family runs W. Hughes Farms and Blue Farm Chips with 5,000 acres. Just ahead, we hear from a University of Toronto researcher who studies chemicals in clothing. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.